Thank you, Rick and Lindsay, and thank you all for coming tonight. This is the second class of a four-class series in a course that is part of what we're calling the Middleway Center curriculum. These classes and courses are meant to sort of change you, change your life. And the way that happens is not only sitting here for an hour, hour and a half listening to me, but putting into practice what you've heard. And that's the key. Otherwise, it's just another hour, hour and a half, 2 hours less that we have to live. So this course is on, this is one of the difficult courses. I've done courses already that are quite introductory and relatively easy to follow and comprehend. This is a course on Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna is one of the great world philosophers from Buddhist India, right around the time of Christ, turn of the Common Era. And as I mentioned to people last night, he's a very interesting philosopher because he doesn't have a philosophy. He has no viewpoint. He has no position that he's trying to propound. And that drives the Western philosophers crazy. They don't know what the hell to do with it. His purpose is to use philosophy to undercut our grasping to philosophy. To use words to undercut our faith in words and concepts. To free us from conceptual thinking. And you know, most of us sort of like fear being freed from conceptual thinking. Like, well, what would that mean? I go brain dead or something, you know. And of course, that's not the goal either. That would be easy for some of us to just go brain dead. But it means to get in touch with the part of you that isn't conceptual, that isn't conceptualizing, that isn't conceptualized, the deeper nature, the true nature that resides in silence, not in words. So words are made possible by silence, right? So he's getting at, he's using words to point us to the silence below words that makes possible words and thought of all sorts. So it is a non-conceptual state that he's trying to get us to, and he's using concepts to get us there. So it's very interesting. He's like using concepts to explode concepts. Playing with words, as we were saying last night. Playing with words to show us how slippery words really are when it comes to understanding how things really are and who we are. So tonight, last night we talked, we did a class on chapter 3 of Nagarjuna's most famous text, the Mula Madhyamaka Karika, the verses, Karika, on the roots, Mula, of Madhyamaka, the middle way. It's fun to say that, isn't it? Middle way between two extremes, between the extreme on the one hand of thinking that things exist the way they seem to. And they do not exist the way they seem to. We are deluded. We are in wandering around in a dreamlike, illusory state, believing in impossible things. And that's one of his missions, is to show how impossible the things are that we believe in. That's one extreme. The other extreme is thinking, well, if things don't exist the way they seem to, then they don't exist at all somehow. And falling into some darkness, void, black hole of non-existence. And that's not what he's arguing either. That's another extreme. So the middle way is between those two extremes. Things do exist, but they don't exist the way they seem to. They do exist, avoiding the extreme of non-existence, but they do not exist the way they seem to. So one of the ways that they seem to exist, things and ourselves, is as independent things. Independent means separated from each other. Separated from each other as human beings, separated from the world around us. That we have an independent existence as a person who then interacts with independent things and objects and people in the world. And that is an illusion. we have never existed that way. We never will exist that way. We do not exist that way now. We exist entirely and only in relationship. In relationship. No man or a woman is an island. It is all just an archipelago. Did I say that right? Did I say that right? I never knew how to say that word. Archipelago. Well, I just said it with an accent. Come on. So last night we went through a chapter where Nagarjuna proved that there cannot be a self-existent subject, there cannot be a self-existent object, and there cannot be a self-existent relationship between them, that all three need each other to be. He used the example of the seer. The chapter was on the senses, which is one way that we kind of like understand ourselves, right? That's the kind of HQ that uses one or another senses, that, you know, to be a seer, to be a feeler, to be a hearer, a taster, and a smeller. And also they throw in a sixth one, a thinker. Thinking is a sense organ in South Asia. So Nagarjuna says there is no seer until and unless the seer sees something. A visible object. What does it mean to say I'm a seer unless I'm seeing something? Can't be a seer all by yourself. You need a visible object. And a visible object isn't visible until and unless it's seen. And that's even harder for us to get our heads around. There are no visible... It makes no sense, listen to the language, to say that there is a visible object that isn't seen. It would be an invisible visible object. Invisible means not seen. So it can't be a visible object until and unless it's seen. Can't be a seer without a visible object, can't be a visible object without a seer. And there can be neither one without the seeing that links the two. And the seeing can't happen all by itself either. Can't have just free-floating seeing. You know, there has to be a seer who is seeing, and there has to be a visible object that is the object of the seeing. And everything works that way, and that's what they call interdependence, not dependence. The seer doesn't depend on the visible object. Why? Because that would mean that the visible object was there as a visible object before the seer sees it. And then the seer would depend on it. Okay? So it's not a matter of dependence. It's a matter of interdependence. No one of those three can exist without the other. No one of those three can exist independently. And that's a very, very profound teaching. That's a very, very different way of thinking about the reality of things. You know, it's the reality of things, actually. Isn't it? But we don't realize that almost ever. We go through our whole lives thinking, well, there's just a little me in here. There's a me all by myself in there that then, you know, kind of bumps into the world and other people in the world, you know, kind of randomly and accidentally, and then we have some kind of like, you know, interaction. But it's not the way it is. You don't have relationships. You are relationships. You don't have a relationship with other people or the world around you. You are that. You are part of that whole. And to break down the kind of isolation, the sense of separateness and isolation that we feel by grasping onto the illusion of an independently existing self. Independent means all, doesn't need anything. Independent means does not depend or interdepend. You see, independence means all by yourself. You could somehow be all by yourself as a seer, a hearer, a listener, you know, and all those. I can't remember. Or a thinker, for that matter. So let's try that one and we'll move on. You can't be a thinker until and unless you thunk something. Right? You can't just be there all by yourself a thinker. What are you doing? I'm a thinker. What are you doing? Nothing. I'm not thinking. I'm a thinker, but I'm not having any thought yet. Soon I will think, and I'll think a thought, but I'm a thinker. Right? You can't be a thinker until you thunk a thought. The thought makes possible the thinker, and the thinking makes possible both the thinker and the thought. Just like all the other ones. You can run this cookie cutter through any relationship whatsoever. That is how things exist. They exist interdependently and they are empty, devoid of existing in any other way than that. And that's what emptiness means. Emptiness means they do not exist in any other way than interdependently. So sometimes people hear this like word emptiness, shunya, shunyata, and they get there, you know, they get all like twisted up about it. And they over-complexify it. It's not that hard. It's not that big of a deal to understand emptiness. It just means that things do not exist independently. They only exist interdependently. Okay? So we only exist interdependently with the world around us. Only. See, we don't run into the world around us. We are defined by the world around us. And the world around us is defined by us. Our world around us, you see? And neither one can come first. Neither one can come first. You're a seer when you see a visible object. And a visible object is a visible object when it's seen by a seer. Alright, not tonight. Tonight's called Chapter 4, which follows Chapter 3. Strangely enough. And it's called the analysis of the parts of a person. The parts of a person. So we're trying, you know, we're getting, the theme of this course is the emptiness of the self. The fact that the self doesn't exist the way we think it does. Which doesn't mean it doesn't exist at all. The self does exist, but interdependently, not independently. So we're trying from different, Nagarjuna is trying from different angles to undercut our grasping to an independently existing self. A self that is impossible. Is a total illusion. So he's trying to smash the illusion that we are grasping onto very tightly. Is it just me? That's grasping on to the notion that there is an I, there's a me that has some kind of independent existence and not just being, you know, part of a relationship that actually extends throughout the cosmos as a whole. Not limited, you know. Like that that butterfly syndrome, you know? Like when a butterfly flaps its wings in China, everything else is affected. We all are affecting everything else. We are living in a grand whole, a grand network. And there are no nodes in that network. It is just network. Nodes in the network would also imply some independent individual node that then connects with other nodes. It's just network. And that should be good news, you see. That is the oceanic feeling that Sigmund Freud once talked about. He said he didn't have it. He had no idea what they were talking about. He was tone deaf to the idea of an oceanic feeling. Oceanic feeling means a feeling of belonging to the cosmos as a whole, losing yourself in the greater and undifferentiated whole. Instead of feeling like a snowflake, you know, in a snow globe, one, you know, unique little snowflake in the snow globe, of identifying with the globe, realizing that you are not part of a whole, but are the whole itself. So tonight is the emptiness of the parts of the self, which means the fact that the parts of us do not, no one of them or any of them or all of them can exist independently of the others. So what are the parts of the self? These are called the skandhas for the Buddha heads here, skandhas. Heaps, they call them. So as English translation, heaps or aggregates, piles of stuff, you know. And the one he'll be using throughout chapter 4 as an example for all the rest, you know. What's that called? A metonym? Where one thing stands for the rest of the category? Something like that. He'll be using rupa, what's called rupa in Sanskrit. Rupa means literally means form. I've been trying for years to find a better translation because what it really means is anything tangible. perceptible, tangible, not perceptible. Because there are, you know, we have mental parts of us that are also perceptible. But tangible means, you know, stuff, matter. So it means, among other things, your body, which is tangible, right? It's physical. But it doesn't just mean that. It means everything that you encounter that is tangible. And that's the case also even in the Abhidhamma texts, even in the early Buddhist texts that Nagarjuna tends to like wanting to slam all the time. But that's what rupa means. Rupa means physicality, you could say. Matter, I don't know. You know, try out different words to point in the right direction, you know, of what he's talking about by rupa. And that's one part of us, of course. We are our physicality. And we identify with our physicality, don't we? You know, all the time. When we are trying to figure out who we are, one of the directions that we go in is, well, I am my body. I am my biological being. And so we do identify with it. If I ask you how old you are, if you gave me a number, you have identified with your body. You know, so sometimes like airy-fairy Buddhists don't like to say, oh, no, I don't know, I know I'm not my body. Well, how old are you? And then they say, I'm 47. Like, boom! You know, you just identified with your body. So that's one of the five heaps or aggregates or collections of things, because the body isn't one thing either, is it? We say we have a body, but that's just a label that we place on, you know, infinitely divisible parts, physical parts, right? So you know, are you your body? Are you still your body if your thumb gets cut off? Yeah. Well, of course, you know, you just reconstitute what counts as your body. It's just an idea, you see what I mean? It's a label or an idea of it on constantly changing and multiple parts. And, you know, you could start chopping away a lot of stuff before you'd say, I don't have a body. You know what I mean? There was a Monty Python movie like that.
Nearly a
flip. What was the name of that movie? The
Holy Grail.
No, it was the other one.
Holy Grail.
In Search of the Holy Grail.
Why don't we know?
So, then there is there are four aspects of our mental being, of our mental parts of our mental life that are identified, and these are all, again, heaps. These are all like collections of things. The first one is feelings. You know, feelings are all kinds of feelings. We've got all kinds of feelings, right? Happy feelings, sad feelings, angry feelings, etc., etc., etc. So a group of feelings, the feelings. And then there is discriminatory thought, which means the ability to tell one thing from another. And those are also heaps. It's not just one ability. So we have the ability to do that visually. So we can like tell like the difference between two visible objects. We do that auditorially to tell the difference between different sounds. We do that with our nose to smell different smells, etc. So that's discriminatory thought. Then consciousnesses, and again, you put it in the plural because we have all different kinds of consciousnesses. We have visual consciousness, we have audio consciousness, consciousness of sound, consciousness of sight, or consciousness of thought. Consciousness of thought is just one kind of consciousness. You know, you're conscious of what you're thinking, but you're also conscious of what you see, hear, feel, taste, smell, right? And then the last one, the fifth one, the fourth of the mental parts of ourselves, and the fifth one of all the parts of ourselves is, in Sanskrit, it's called the samskaras, samskara. And there's lots of different translations of that. But samskara is, in Sanskrit, is a synonym for another Sanskrit word, vasana. Vasana in vasana means imprints, mental imprints. It means like the remnant of the smell of perfume after a woman has left the room. You know, it leaves an odor behind, and those imprints come from our past. You know, the past is gone, right? You do something, you say something in the past, you know, then it ends. But it leaves an aroma. It leaves a scent in the mind. And that's the samskara. So I've translated it predispositions. Predispositions. kind of habitual ways of responding and thinking because of the, you know, the perfume that's been left from past actions. You get it? So he's going to try and show here, he will show, we have to try and figure it out, but he's definitely showing it, that these five parts of us are empty, which means that no one of them can exist on its own. And he'll do it in a very interesting manner. Because one of the other things that he's going to cover in this chapter, while he's up, kind of, you know, is how causation is impossible. Yeah. Which, you know, again, is one of the purposes of Nagarjuna's text as a whole, it seems to me, is to undercut Buddhist orthodoxy. He's the greatest Buddhist philosopher who's ever lived, busy undercutting Buddhist philosophy, Buddhist orthodoxy. Because, of course, the Buddhist, if you know one thing you probably know about Buddhism, is that, well, you know, think cause and effect. Everything's cause and effect, and the nexus of cause and effect. And Nagarjuna show you how that's impossible. Ready? Here we go. There is no form apart from the cause of that form. There is no form, there is no physical form, matter, apart from a cause that brought the thing into being. And the cause of a form is not perceived apart from that form. And already, right with the second line, he's getting us in trouble. First line, we go, yes, there's no form apart from the cause of that form, it's everything's cause. You know, and then the second thing he says is, and the cause of a form is not perceived. Drishyate means you can't see it until and unless there's the form that is the effect of the cause. So one of the, preview where we're going here, because it's probably important to hear it more than once. But here's the emptiness of causation. There can be no cause without an effect. But there can also be no effect without a cause. Everyone okay with that? And neither one can come first. Which comes first, the cause or the effect? Well, of course, the cause has to come first, right? Cause comes first, and then the effect comes. But the effect isn't an effect unless there's a cause, right? So you could say that the cause is as dependent on the effect as the effect is dependent on the cause. And so that's interdependence also. See, that's also interdependence. There is no cause without an effect, but there's no effect without a cause, and neither one can come first. The cause is a cause because an effect has come about, and not until. It isn't a cause until there's an effect. So, and there isn't an effect, of course, without a cause. And neither one can come first. Okay? Noodles baking here a little bit? little sizzle on the grill? Yeah. So, you know, causation is a retroactive projection. When there is an effect, you retroactively project a cause that is no longer there. Right? All right, well, people get to... Just a little preview, all right? Just a little preview. Relax. Okay, go. Take it easy. Take a cold drink. Replenish some bodily fluids here. All right? The self we think we have would have to be findable either somewhere within the parts, the mind-body complex, or apart from the parts. Okay? The self that we think we have, you could put it like this, Nagarjuna loves to do stuff like this. The self would either have to be the same as the parts or different than the parts. Right? That's logic, isn't it? There's no third possibility. Same as, different from. So if it's the same as the parts, those are the parts, you know, he's talking about the parts of ourselves. Then we must be able to find it somewhere in there. The self that we think exists. So what kind of self is that? Was an unchanging self? It's an independent self. It's a, you know, it's a self that's impossible to change. So it either has to be the same as the parts or different than the parts. And different than the parts he's not going to go into in this chapter. Because different than the parts is a whole other problem. You know, if you are different than your body and mind, then where are you? Right? You're somehow like free floating out there in space while your body and mind are sitting in a chair here? See? And that's not usually how we think of ourselves. We don't usually think of ourselves as somehow separable from the mind-body complex, do we? I don't think usually. Sometimes our language betrays us and says, I have a body and mind. Which kind of indicates linguistically that you're not the body and mind, you are a possessor of the body and mind. That would be an independently existing self that could be found apart from the body and mind. So here's going to go for the first one. Let's analyze the first one. If there's a self the way we think we are, we should be able to find it in the mind-body complex somewhere. And it's just not fine. I'll tell you right now, it's not fine. The opening verse, as usual, states the basic argument of the chapter as a whole. This is, by the way, for those of you who are new, the stuff in bold and italics is my commentary on the Sanskrit translation. The opening verse, as usual, states the basic argument of the chapter as a whole. Physical form or matter, one of the main parts of the person, rupa, form, cannot be perceived apart from its cause. And in the traditional Indian system, the cause of matter is one of the four elements, what they call the four elements. Earth, air, fire, and water. Those are sometimes referred to as the causal forms. And then resultant forms come from that. So like a tree, you know, comes from the combination of these four elements. Solidity, liquidity, mobility, and heat, you know, temperature. And that's the case with all form. That's the case with all physical form. Okay? So the physical form or matter cannot be perceived apart from its cause. For the cause is what makes the effect possible. So far, so good. But the cause of a form is not a cause until and unless there is an effect. I.e., in this case, a form. So a tree has to be there for you to say that the tree was caused by the four elements. The effect has to be there before the cause, in a sense. The effect has to be there for the cause to be a cause. And the cause has to be there, of course, for there to be an effect. And neither one can come first. That's the key. That's the key. Causality itself is a kind of an illusion. The way we ordinarily think about causality has got to be an illusion. It is at best a projection. Retroactively projecting a cause once there is an effect. Because a cause isn't a cause until there is an effect. Okay? Alright, next verse. Were there a form that emanated as a form, apart from the cause of that form, then it would be causeless. Everyone understand what he's saying? If there was a form that came into being without a cause of the form, then it would be a causeless thing. No cause to it. But there are no objects whatsoever that are causeless. And the guardian just like slaps you upside the head. Objects here, artha, seems to be a kind of a synonym for rupa. Rupa means form. Artha means, in this context, it means a tangible object. There are no, and he's not mincing words. Kaschit. Kaschit in Sanskrit means whatsoever. Nothing whatsoever can come into being without a cause. Can emanate. I've translated this word emanate. Prasaj in Sanskrit means results from or follows from, the consequence of. So there, if there were a form that was the consequence of apart from the cause of that form, see, then it would be causeless. Nir mukta, apart from mukta. Some of you know the word mukta or mukti or moksha is freedom. So nir mukti means the opposite. It is not free from its cause. It can't be free from its cause. Nagarjuna begins here by saying that form which isn't caused is impossible. For there is no entity or object of sense perception, artha, which does not come into existence due to causes and conditions. The various components of a person's body, for example, arise because of causes, which in the ancient Indian system were identified as the four elements. The earth element is the cause of skin and bones. The water element brings about blood and other bodily fluids. The fire element produces body heat or temperature, and the air element causes respiration and mobility. And Nagarjuna says here quite clearly, no objects whatsoever that are causes. So far, so good. Next verse. And if there were a cause of a form apart from that form, it would be a cause without an effect. Okay? If there was a cause for a form that existed apart from the form, it could exist independently as a cause without needing an effect. And that's impossible, right? Can't be a cause until and unless there's an effect. It can't be a cause all by itself as a cause. So he's saying in the last verse, 4:2, there can't be an effect all by itself without a cause. That would be a causeless thing. And in this verse, he's kind of reversing the situation. And there can't be a cause without the effect of the cause. Can't be an effect without a cause. Can't be a cause without an effect. So far, so good. And then he says here, again, kind of reiterating, and there is no cause without an effect. It's an impossible thing. Having noted that it can be no effect without a cause, Nagarjuna here drops the other shoe. There can also be no cause without an effect. A cause is a cause when it brings about an effect and not until. Right? Everyone okay? Just keep nodding or else I have to say it over and over again. And that's why Nagarjuna can state that there is no cause without an effect. So which comes first? If we say, as would seem commonsensical, that the cause of any form must come before the form, then we would have a cause for a result before the result occurs. And it can't be a cause until the result occurs. But a cause is only a cause when it brings about a result, that is, after the result. A cause is only a cause after the result occurs. Not before. A cause without a result cannot be said to be a cause. So actually, neither cause nor effect can come first. Neither can exist without the other, that is, independently. Each requires the other to be what it is, a cause or an effect, and so each exists only interdependently with the other. Not independently, not dependently. The result is not dependent on the cause. The cause and the effect can only exist interdependently, because neither one can come first. When a form exists, the cause of that form does not occur. All right, now he's getting a little deeper. What do you mean, Nagarjuna? What are you talking about? When a form exists, the cause of that form does not occur. It's not there anymore. See, it's like a sprout. When a sprout comes from a seed, so the seed is the cause of the sprout, but when the sprout sprouts, the seed is gone. The cause isn't there when the effect has occurred. Right? The cause no longer exists when the effect is brought about. When a form does not exist, the cause of that form does not occur either. So having shown that neither cause nor effect can exist before or without the other, Nagarjuna now delves a little deeper, problematizing the issue of cause and effect. If we say that a form, like the human body, for example, back to the body, you know, make it personal here a little bit. If we say a form already exists, the cause of that form no longer is there, just like the sprout example I just gave. Put otherwise, if the effect already exists, if the body already exists, what need does it have of a cause? It's already there. Right? To say that there exists a cause for an effect that is already there would be unnecessary and redundant. To say it has a cause when it's already the result would be redundant. It doesn't need a cause. I don't need no damn cause. I'm a result. I'm already in effect. What do I need with causes? Right? If you're already in effect, you don't need a cause. For the whole purpose of a cause is to bring about an effect that doesn't need a cause to produce it because it's already produced, is neither an effect nor the result of a cause. If it's already there, it can't be an effect because an effect is the result of a cause, and the thing is already there, so it doesn't need a cause. So it can't be an effect if it's already there. Oh, come on! Oh, crying uncle already, Gretchen. Where's the bell?
Now she knows.
Remember what I told you the purpose of all this is? Is to try and loosen your grip on rationality. On thinking that you can, like, pigeonhole the world into your logical conceptions. The problem is thinking. We've got ourselves locked into illusion through our conceptualizations and thought, and have divorced ourselves from true reality because we grasp on so tightly to our intellect and don't relax into the flow, the cosmic flow, which is non-conceptual. Non-conceptual. The Tao that can be named is not the true Tao. Tao means the way, the cosmic way, the ultimate reality. And you can't put a name on it. Anytime you try to name it, to conceptualize it, to theorize it, and so forth, you distort it. So he's using logic against logic. He's using words against words. He's trying to get us to say uncle, like Gretchen sort of did, say uncle to try and figure out the world. You know? Get a grasp mentally, intellectually on the world and think we got it, you know, in our little cage. Where did I leave off? Conversely, if an effect, a form, like the human body, does not yet exist, so now the second part of this verse, when a form does not exist, the cause of that form does not occur, obviously. If there is no effect, how can there be a cause? If an effect, a form, like the human body, does not yet exist and is not already there, there is no sense in saying that there is a cause for it. Okay? Everyone all right? If it's not there, if it's not an effect, you can't say that there's a cause for it. There's no effect. And you have to have both together, cause and effect. They exist interdependently. They can't be separated out. So a body, for example, that does not yet exist, is not already there, you can't say there's a cause for it. It's not there. If the effect isn't there, there can be no cause for it either. If the cause isn't there, there can't be an effect. But if the effect isn't there, there can't be a cause for it. Because as we've seen, neither cause nor effect can exist without the other.
But do the elements exist? Is there something that outside this type
no,
of system?
No. He's got a whole chapter on the elements and how they...
Do they exist?
Yeah, no. Not really. Not truly. Not objective. Not independent. A form without a cause, 4-5. A form without a cause could never, ever occur. So again, he's very emphatic on this. You know, I tried to get it in the English as never, ever. Could never, ever occur. A form without a cause could never, ever occur. So again, kind of reaffirmation of causality. So he's kind of like just playing with us a little bit, you know. It's kind of like teasing us. Come on, y'all. I didn't say it. Takes it away. It's bait and switch. It's a little bait and switch going on. A form without a cause could never ever occur. And so, when it comes to form, one should not conceptualize any conceptualization at all. And that's kind of the cash out on the cause and effect. Forget it. Forget trying to, like, make it make sense. It does not make sense. Causality does not make sense. We think it makes sense. We're so sure it makes sense, right? And in 4 or 5 verses, he's just proven how it makes no sense at all, the way we usually think about it. We usually think that a cause comes first, cause is there first, and then it somehow brings about its effect later, although it's not there anymore, once the effect comes. You know, it's all just magic somehow, you know? It's magical thinking. It isn't logical thinking. It seems logical until you actually penetrate the logic and see that it's totally illogical. There cannot be an effect until and unless there's a cause for the effect. There cannot be a cause until and unless there's an effect, and neither one can come first. And neither one can exist without the other. Can't have a cause that's sitting there as a cause waiting to bring about an effect. That would be an independently existing cause. And there can't be an effect that doesn't need a cause. That would be an independently existing effect. And neither do they exist dependently on them, one on the other. The effect does not exist dependently on the cause, because that would assume a cause that existed before the effect that the effect depended on. And the effect is similar, but like that. So they can only exist interdependently, only. And that's how they exist, and they do not exist in any other way than that. You want to hold your question until we're done? Yeah. Just so we can kind of keep concentrating here a little bit. All right? Nagarjuna has left us in the last verse with the impossibility of effects having causes, and vice versa. If an effect already exists, it needs no cause. And if an effect does not already exist, it's impossible to say that it, being a non-existing thing, because it doesn't exist, has a cause. But here he vociferously insists that an effect, like a form like the human body, without a cause could never, never occur. Things don't happen for no reason. Physical forms like the human body don't just pop up out of thin air. And to believe so is regarded as the pinnacle of ignorance. So here I quote a couple of commentators, classical commentators on the text, one an Indian and one a Tibetan. Chandrakirti says that Nagarjuna is refuting, quote, the extreme wrongfulness of the view that things can be without causes. You know, he's used very strong language. Extreme wrongfulness. Tsongkhapa, you know, the Tibetan commentator, Jesongkhapa, comments that to say existing things do not depend on causes is the stupidest idea ever. This is somebody else's translation, but it seems like a really good one. We are left with the impossibility of saying that effects like form are caused, and also the impossibility or downright harmfulness of saying that they are uncaused. Okay? We're left with the impossibility of saying that effects like form are caused, and also the impossibility of saying that they are uncaused. So what's the conclusion here? Don't say nothing at all. Stop the conceptualization. Stop the verbiage. Stop the thinking that you're going to get it right with your ideas, your language, your conception. Any conceptualization regarding the true nature of form is like thinking about the true nature of rabbit's horns. That's a classical example in the Indian and Tibetan texts. It's like thinking about the horns on a rabbit. And actually, nowadays, you know, I've seen them in bars sometimes. Jackalopes are like unicorns, you know. They're non-existent things. As a general principle, Nagarjuna elsewhere states that all conceptualizations are erroneous, and that the ultimate goal is to pacify the mind, to shut it up, to pacify the mind of such conceptual thinking that distorts reality as it is. So here is a quote from a later chapter of the same text from Nagarjuna. Independent, peaceful, not projected by projections, beyond conceptual thought, undifferentiated. These are the characteristics of reality. So stop thinking that you know. Stop thinking that you know. The conceptualizations are putting us into our prison of our own making, distorting reality. It's like that Talking Heads movie. Stop making sense. Stop making sense. Stop trying to think that you can penetrate the deeper levels of reality with your thinking. And let go. And this is exactly the same sort of project that the Zen masters have with the koan. The koan is a riddle. A riddle without a solution. What's the hand, you know, the classic one. What's the sound of one hand clapping? So now go and think about that for 3 months. You know, that's the usual sort of process. You know, and you just work at it, work at it, work at it, you know, and smoke starts coming out of your ears, and you know, your mind is just, you know, running around trying to find an answer, trying to get the handle on it, you know. And the whole point is to break the mind down so that it stops thinking and you're left with your pure mind. Pure consciousness. A consciousness that isn't polluted by thought. And he's doing exactly the same kind of thing in this whole text. Okay. Next verse. It is not possible that the effect is the same as the cause. It is not possible that the effect is not the same as the cause. So here he does another classical thing. You know, he does this all the time. Is it one thing or many things? Is it independent or dependent? You know, kind of like alternatives. Here he's doing, is it the same as or different from? And it's got to be one or the other, doesn't it? You know, this is our limitations of our logical mind, is that we have to put it into one category or the other. So, the verses, as I say in the first line here, is difficult because the word sadrusha can have a number of different meanings. You know, in the dictionary you'll say resembling or similar to. So I've said the same as to kind of get, I think, more force behind it, because I think that's what he's trying to do. An effect must either be the same as or different from its cause. So which one do you think it is? Same as or different from? Which one? Different from. You assume that would be the logical, the immediate logical answer would be different from. Yeah, cause must be different from. The first option, the same as, is not tenable. For although, for example, matter in general is characterized by solidity, like one of the elements, right? Well, solidity, liquidity, warmth, and mobility, the four elements. Particular resultant forms have different and unique characteristics. So they all come from the same cause, the same causal form. The four elements, but a tree is quite different than a fire hydrant. Right? So not the same as the cause. The effects are not the same as the cause. See? Everyone alright with this? Yeah. But it is also not possible that the effect is not the same as the cause either, also known as different. It is not possible that the effect is not the same as the cause. For if that were the case, then things vastly disparate, like, for example, material and immaterial things, could somehow be in a cause and effect relationship. If they were different from, means have no relation to each other, then you could say that, for example, you could say that my mind could create a tree. I have a thought of a tree. That's a immaterial thing. Thought is immaterial, right? Intangible. And if there wasn't some kind of similarity between the cause and the effect, then an intangible thought could create a tangible object. And that's magic. That's not reality. Now, the word sadrusha here, I tried it from a different point of view. Taking it literally, dursha comes from the same Sanskrit word that brings us drishti, you know, like the focal point that you use in yoga, drishti. It means to see. Dursh means to see. Sadursh means seen together, literally. Sadursha. So if we take the term sadursha in a more literal sense, seen together, Nagarjuna might here be pointing out that an effect can neither occur at the same time as its cause, nor at a time different than its cause. This is the gentleman, I don't know if he's here tonight, who's asking about simultaneity. Could cause and effect occur simultaneously? If we take the truth, the same time as its cause, if the effect occurred at the same time as its cause, there would be no way to distinguish effect from the cause. Right? If the two things happened at once, how could you say one was the cause and one was the effect? But if they occurred at a time different, if the effect occurs at a time different from the cause, there would be no temporal relationship between the two. If the cause occurred at one time and the effect occurs at a later time, what's the relationship between the two? One's gone. The cause is no longer there. It's past. So, and the effect is present. So there's no temporal relationship. There's no relationship of time between them. So they can't occur at the same time, and they can't occur at different times. No more nodding.
No more nodding.
So we've seen in this chapter, we're getting towards the end of the chapter, right? We've seen in this chapter that a cause cannot occur before an effect. It cannot occur after an effect. And with this verse, we learn that the cause also cannot occur simultaneous to the effect. Which means it can't really be occurring at all. And so form, as one of these five heaps that make up the person, cannot be said to be either caused or uncaused, and therefore cannot be said to truly exist at all. And that's the emptiness of form. And then in the next verse he says, and the same logic, 4:7, the same logic used with form in the last six verses applies universally to feelings, discriminatory thought, consciousnesses, and predispositions, the other four parts of ourself, of the person. And then he says, quite interestingly, and indeed to all existing things. To all existing things. The same logic can apply to all existing things. Baba. Nagarjuna here just states that all the previous observations about form hold true for the other four keeps or principal parts of the person, etc. What he is suggesting is that if you understand the emptiness of any one part of what makes up the person, form in this case, you understand the emptiness of all the others. This is a regular sort of observation in Buddhist philosophy. If you can get to the emptiness of any one object, the same holds true for all other objects. You don't have to prove the emptiness of each object in the universe one by one. The same logic applies. Emptiness here again means the lack of independent existence. The lack of, the absence of independent existence. Things do exist. How? This is going to be the Sesame Street word of the course. Interdependently. This show has been brought to you by the word interdependence. And the absence of independence. So then one of the commentators quotes a very profound verse from the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. Just as you understand yourself, so too can you understand all living beings. Just as you understand all living beings, so too can you understand all things. So this is a kind of a statement for those of you who know the lingo. The first two lines refer to the emptiness of the person. Just as you understand yourself, so too can you understand all living beings. The emptiness of me, the person, is also the same as the emptiness of everyone, all the other persons. Then the next two verses are on the emptiness of what they call phenomena, you know, objects in the world. Just as you understand all living beings, so too can you understand all things. So a cause can't exist without a result, and a result can't exist without a cause. And neither can exist, but neither can they exist simultaneously. Okay? That's the summary of what we just talked about. Why can't they exist simultaneously? Remember? What? Why? Yeah, I couldn't distinguish one from the other. You couldn't say one's a cause and one's an effect if they're both there at the same time. Cause can't exist without a result. Result can't exist without a cause. And neither can they exist simultaneously with each other. So, to extend out that a little bit, extend out a little bit from what he's saying in this chapter. The parts of the self cannot exist without the self, and the self can't exist without the parts of the self. Okay? So what does that mean? The parts of me, for example, my hands and arms and so forth of my body, are not parts of my body until and unless I have a body. They're just random, like, you know, flesh and blood things. They become parts of the body only when there is a body, right? Conceptualize the notion of a body. And there can't be a conceptualized notion of a body without parts, right? You can't just imagine a body that doesn't have parts. What would that body look like? It would be everything. Literally, it would be undistinguishable from anything else if it had no parts, right? Yeah? So the whole, a whole, W-H-O-L-E, depends on its parts, and the parts depend on the whole, and neither one can come first. They exist interdependently. Let me use another example. Everyone got a car, right? There are no parts of a car until and unless there's a car for them to be parts of. Right? And there's no car, of course, without parts. And neither one can come first. Can't have a car without parts, but you can't have parts of a car unless there's a conception of car. And neither one can come first. Same argument as cause and effect argument. Parts and whole. Okay? The self can't exist without the world, and the world can't exist without the self. And neither one can come first. Right? And that was kind of referring back to our class yesterday. That there are no visible objects until unless there's a seer of visible objects. But there are no seer of a visible object until and unless there's visible objects. And neither one can come first. They can exist only interdependent. Only interdependent. Now, the last two verses are regarded in the commentators by the commentators as being applicable to any chapter in Nagarjuna. One of the commentators, Buddha Palita, says these two verses should be attached to every chapter of the 27th chapters of this text. When someone in a debate argues against emptiness, everything he or she asserts is exactly what needs to be proved. This is Nagarjuna doing a kind of a rope-a-dope. You know, like Muhammad Ali used to do the rope-a-dope, like, can't touch this. Just try and hit me. Just try and refute me. So what does he mean by this? When someone in a debate argues against emptiness, everything he or she asserts is exactly what needs to be proved. Any assertion made that any object or all things are not empty of inherent self-existence will presuppose something which the opponent has assumed must have some kind of inherent self-existence. But this is exactly what needs to be proved, and so begs the question. So for example, to say things aren't empty presumes things that aren't empty. To say things aren't empty presumes things. So it begs the question. And then you can work that the other way around too. To say things are empty is equally false for exactly the same reason. See? Because you presumed something. There's a thing. And thing always kind of like has the connotation at least of being independent from other things. Which means that it would be not empty. Things. So to say things are empty is a contradiction in terms. To say things aren't empty presupposes something that you're trying to prove. A non-empty thing. Things aren't empty presumes that there's a thing that isn't empty. See? So Nagarjuna's gotcha. He's gotcha, you know, right where he wanted. There's no refutation of this is the kind of thing that drives the Western philosophy just crazy. go ape shit about this, you know, because he's got no position. He's not arguing any position. He's just saying everyone else's position is false. Everyone else is wrong. I'm not saying I'm right, but everyone else is wrong. You can say it like that. Next verse. When an explanation of emptiness is put forward and someone criticizes it, everything he or she criticizes is exactly what needs to be proved. Any criticism of the assertion that things are empty of inherent self-existence is just a sign of some kind of grasping to something which is presumed to have inherent self-existence. And such a presumption is, again, exactly what needs to be proved. So in the last paragraph here of that, you know, I just sort of summarized it already verbally, that he's doing this kind of like rope-a-dope thing, where he's saying, you know, you can't touch this. This argument is irrefutable. And, you know, 2,000 years have gone by and nobody's managed to refute it. So, you know, if you think that you're going to refute it in one night, well, be my guest. The height of arrogance, perhaps, but go ahead and try. But the reason it can't be refuted, because there's no argument to refute. It's just a negation. It's just a one after another rug being pulled out from underneath you until you have no place to stand. And that's the point again. The point is to have no security, intellectual security, of knowing, I know how things are. Because this is a prison for us. We are imprisoned by our own, you know, false sense of security. Everything is empty. Everything exists interdependently. Nothing exists independently. And all our attempts to find an independently existing self or object is an attempt to find security. To find something to hold on to. Something that isn't just like, you know, kind of vaporous. You know, losing itself in some larger whole. So that's the emptiness of the parts of the person. Which is also the emptiness of causation. And causation, of course, the emptiness of causation means also the emptiness of karma. And there's whole chapters on this, but, you know, this one's already pointing at it. Causation and karma are kind of like synonymous, isn't it, in Buddhist philosophy? Yeah. And so you can think about it. You can think about the fact that there is no cause without an effect, and there's no effect without a cause, and neither one can come first. And what does that signify for what you think, you know, karma means? Where is karma? You asked me. What do you mean there's no karma? There is karma, but it doesn't work the way you think it does. It doesn't work like there's a karmic seed that's planted, you know, sometime in time, and then time goes on and that karmic seed ripens into a karmic effect for exactly the reasons he spent the last 9 verses talking about. Can't exist that way. It can't exist that way. So one implication of this. Karma exists only in the present mind. Only in the present. Okay? Both cause and effect have to exist only in the present. Because the past is gone. The cause is gone.
But not simultaneously.
But not simultaneously either. Right? For just the reasons that he talked about. And so karma doesn't work the way we think it does either. But that's a whole other course. I think I will do a course on Nagarjuna, on karma. I think I'll like spring that on the Singaporeans in November. Because there's plenty of chapters that relate to karma per se. This one isn't on karma per se. But it does deal obviously with causation, and you know, it's the argument that he's making here is very applicable to what we think karma is all about also. So there's no independent self within or the same as the mind-body complex. And there's no independent self that exists apart from the mind-body complex. So where is the independent existing self? It's like trying to find Waldo but Waldo ain't there. So among the other sort of takeaways on a chapter like this is getting a little bit detached to your body, because he's using the body as a kind of an example, you know, throughout the whole verse. And getting it detached a little bit from your, you know, idea that you are your body. But he says you can run the same argument through all the mental parts too. So as some of you know, hopefully, there's an exercise attached with each one of these classes. Here's exercise for class two. Another kind of contemplation exercise, but I tried to like modernize it a little bit. For the next week, set aside 15 minutes a day to contemplate where you came from. In ancient India, they say we came from the elements. In our modern society, science has taught us that our body and mind somehow originally came into being by an egg in our mother's body being fertilized by our father's seed. So Nagarjuna's argument is applicable to scientific explanations of causality as they are to, you know, ancient Indian explanations of causality. How could it be? Is it really possible, the third verse, is it really possible, the third paragraph, is it really possible, according to the argument presented in this chapter, that the mind and body are the effect of a cause like a fertilized egg? And run the same argument, you know, only apply it now to, you know, to modern scientific explanation, which is kind of harder to do, in a way, because we're really attached to modern science as being right about everything, you see. You know, science is a very, very valuable thing. I'm not saying that, you know. People like criticize me for criticizing science. Like, I like science. I like air conditioning, for example. I like my iPod, you know. I like, it's fine. But to, like, sit there and worship at the altar of science as if they got it all down is a big mistake. Does science have a history? Yes or no?
Yeah.
See, that's the problem right there. It changes.
Yeah.
You know, and today's truism is going to be, you know, 10 years, 15, 20 years from now, it's going to be the, you know, yesterday, you know, today's mythology. It'll be regarded as mythology, the same kind of way that, you know, we do with science that has been discarded from the past. Science is a changing thing, so don't get overly attached to it. And apply, you see, apply what Nagarjuna is saying to your own sense of where you think you came from. You know? And usually, I think, if you're like me, you've been indoctrinated to think, well, I came from a fertilized egg, somehow. My body and mind came from a cause. And then you just run the same argument. Could the cause exist before the effect? Or does the effect exist before the cause? Which one can come first? Does the body exist before the egg is fertilized or after the egg is fertilized? And there are problems either way. Cause can't exist without an effect, and effect can't exist without a cause. So we can say that we, you know, our body and mind are the effect of a fertilized egg cause, but that can only occur retroactively. That can only occur as a kind of projection. Retroactively applied. And, you know, just run it through. You do the contemplation. Think about this. You know, an hour and a half, 2 hours of getting hit up by Nagarjuna is not enough. I've been studying this text for years now, and it's quite amazing. You know, I sit there, I translate the Sanskrit, trying to figure out what the hell he's saying, sit there, finally think I understand what he's saying, and as soon as I get up from the desk, it's like it never happened. Yeah. You know? And the veil of ignorance comes crashing down again. And like it just went in one ear, out the other. You got to meditate on this. You see, contemplate and meditate on it over and over and over again to let it sink in, or, you know. To have the woodpecker, you know, peck the hard wood little by little by little and make the hole. A couple of pecks isn't going to do that much. You got a couple of pecks tonight. So take it home and turn the woodpecker on. Okay, questions, yeah.
Yeah, this sounds an awful lot like particle theory. That, you know, that there, the location of a particle, you know what, you can know one thing about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, that you really can't know where a particle is if you insist on Knowing what its speed is.
Yeah.
You can only know one thing. You can't know both. And then, well, like the Higgs field, that these little bits of energy, some of them become matter, but this field also exists in space where there's nothing. And of course, throughout the whole universe, which is immense. And stuff like that, which nobody understands. And so that's, you know, I wouldn't be too quick to say that modern science is inconsistent with this.
No, right.
It looks like, in fact, it's just as befuddled as
Yeah, quantum physics is a whole other thing, you know.
Well, but it's not actually very simple. Similar.
No, I'm saying, but it's kind of like
old-fashioned science.
Right, and the kind of science that the layperson is mostly going around, you know, thinking is science. Quantum physics has thrown the whole thing up for grabs, hasn't it? In ways that I don't understand at all.
Okay.
I mean, I don't understand. But from what I understand from people like you who do understand, it sounds like they're getting to the same conclusion, same kinds of conclusions.
What did Nagarjuna think about the loss of karma?
Well, Nagarjuna, it's similar to the argument here, the statement here, that, of course, nothing can exist without a cause. He's kind of reaffirming causality while undercutting it at the same time. And so he affirms, of course, that karma does work. But not the way we think it works. It is empty of having an independent existence like everything else, which is a very interesting thing to think about. Well, what would karma sort of look like if we didn't conceptualize it as having an independent existence? And one way to kind of go at that is to say there is no karma unless we sustain it. That karma is not working independently of us who are, you know, kind of experiencing it, buying into it. And as I've been saying for many times now, for the past couple of years, the purpose of the spiritual practices, of all Indian-based spiritual practices, is not to improve your karma. It's to escape karma. Yeah, that's what liberation means. Liberation means escaping the compulsion that karma is. Karma is a compulsion to act, think, or speak the way that we do, a feeling that we have to do it. And that's not freedom. And even good karma is not freedom. Good karma is just better than bad karma, but it's not freedom. So if karma had an independently operating existence, how could you ever escape it? If it were like a law of nature, how could you ever escape it? It's not. It can't be like a law of nature. So that's a whole other big topic, and just entre nous. I think maybe the next book will be on karma, but I gotta think about it for a couple years first. Because, karma does work, but it can't work the way we think it works. So how does it work? And most importantly, how can we get out of its grip in order to live freely, spontaneously, without compulsion, like that? Because that is the goal. That has always been the goal. In Buddhist tradition, Hindu tradition, yoga tradition, is to escape karma. Not to try to... You can't get enlightened through karma. In fact, it's just the opposite. You will stay unenlightened because of karma, both good and bad. So it's a kind of another kind of prison that we put ourselves into. Karma, as a prison. And breaking out of that is the whole point. So sorry to be a little vague about it, but I do need a couple of years to really figure this out.
It was a question I almost
went to work. Yeah. I mean, one thing I would like to say about it, I haven't said this in the talks at Cape Ann and Newburyport, is that karma is entirely about intention. So the good karma has a certain kind of selfless intention. Bad karma has a negative and selfish intention. So it doesn't really matter what you do, say, or think. It's what the intention is behind what you do, say, or think. The very same act can be good or bad depending on the intention. Very same act. So, for example, if someone took a knife and cut you open, that act could have two very different understandings depending on the intention. If the surgeon was cutting you open to take the cancer out, that would be one kind of like understanding of that act. But if a robber's coming and the switchblade and cuts you open to take your money, that'd be a very different understanding of the act. And it depends on the intention. It depends on your understanding of the other person's intention too. So the karma from the subjective point of view, the producing of karma, depends on what kind of an intention you have as a producer. But the experience of karma depends on what you imagine the intention of the other person to be. So that then gets to the possibility then of having a mindset in which you suppose that the only intention that other people have is beneficial to you. Yeah, and that's the power of love, as Lindsay was saying. And then you are free from karma in a way. See, free from positive and negative karma, because it's all just lost in love. Yeah. So you can practice that by thinking the best of other people. You can practice that. And that helps you also think the best for other people. Thinking the best of other people helps you think the best for other people. And you work the intention, and that's working the karma. That's really how you work karma. That's really how you change karma. And eventually, I think there's a breakout somewhere. Yeah. You blow it out of the water. You break it all down somewhere. Yeah. Good to see you.
Just a question on I'm having a consistency problem. Between the discussion, on seer object seeing and the simultaneous arising, in which we're able to make a differentiation even though it's a simultaneous arising. And I'm not equating, but they're close in the cause and effect discussion. We have a simultaneous arising and a non-differentiation. It's a complicated equation because they're arising together. But yet, in the seeing, they arose together simultaneously and didn't make a differentiation between seeing and seer. So, my question is that, and the only way that I can establish, in a few minutes, I had to think about it, a valid position for the differentiation is that in the seeing paradigm, we're talking about a result rather than a cause. So that the seer can only be a seer if there is something to be seen, and that results in the seer being a seer. There's the thing being seen doesn't cause the seer to be a seer. Whereas in the second cause and effect discussion, there is in fact a set cause and effect. So it strikes me as something more, in my mind, is something more than semantics to say one is result oriented and one is cause and effect oriented. But I'm trying to find out why there's that inconsistency in one simultaneous thing's happening. We make a differentiation, but we don't make that differentiation in the straight cause and effect analysis.
Well, first of all, chapter 4 follows chapter 3, so it's kind of setting chapter 4 up in chapter 3 with the seer seeing. Visible object. But the argument in chapter 4 seems to me to be retroapplicable to chapter 3 also. Because, which comes first? Does the visible object come first, or does the seer come first? Which is the cause and which is the effect? And neither one can be either one, you see. I don't think, I was trying to be careful last night to say that the seer the visible object and the seeing do not exist simultaneously either, because I wanted to try to be true to Nagarjuna's argument. Nagarjuna's not arguing that they are simultaneous. This is another one of his dichotomies. Things have to exist either sequentially or simultaneously. Sequentially or simultaneously. Either or, right? One or the other. Pick it. So it can't exist sequentially because one can't exist without the other. This visible object can't exist without the seer and so forth. But they can't exist simultaneously either, because that assumes three independent things that arise at the same time. That's what we mean when we say simultaneously arising.
But the initial argument is that they arise at the same time. He's trying it out.
Yeah, he's saying that's the wrong way to think about it. That's another way to kind of veer into independent existence. To say that two or more things come into existence simultaneously sort of presumes that they have independent existence and they just happen to be at the same time at the same place.
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry. I couldn't be more clear about that yesterday. Yeah.
Thank you. I missed you.
If you can say that after two classes in the garden,
so does that mean that they don't exist? Or we're right back to they don't exist and think they exist.
That's right.
You can't figure that out yet.
That's right. He's just trying to destabilize.
They exist, but just not the way we think they exist.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
They
when exist.
Do we get to that?
No, he says. I just cut to the chase already.
Just what I thought I had.
That's the deal.
Yeah, right. Thank you.
No rest for the weary.
In several parts in the text, he says, things exist like a dream, like a magic show, like a ghost town. Things exist, but they exist in a dreamlike, illusory fashion. And just as in a dream, you know, there is a reality to the dream. You know, you laugh, you cry, you do all kinds of things in a dream. You wake up sometimes because you're so frightened because of the dream. You know, it has a kind of reality, but not the reality that we think it has. Dreamlike reality. So, row, row, row your boat. Gently down the stream. Merrily.
Merrily.
Because life is but a dream. So relax already. Chill out. You know, if we live life like a waking dream, like a lucid dream, when you're lucid in the dream, you know, the stuff is still all happening, but you have this kind of like detachment about it, this kind of like, you know, you're just watching it, and you know it's a dream, you know it's just a dream, so you don't get all worked up about it, and that's kind of what he's pointing to by saying life is like a dream. So don't get all worked up about it. Don't take it so personal, for one thing. You know, because who the hell is it that you're, you know, who's the person that's taking it personal? See, so don't take it so personal and don't take it so seriously. You know, kind of have a little sort of step back from it. It's unfolding just like a dream unfolds. You know, Lama Suryadas, who's a friend of mine, likes to use the example of going to
Macy's Day Parade.
Yeah, a parade. It's a hard word for me to remember. So he says, you know, it's just like at the Macy's Day Parade, you watch the floats go by, and ooh, a turkey, ooh, Charlie Brown, and ooh, and there's a scary float, ooh, there's a nasty float, ooh, but it's just like a spectator watching it go by without like getting all involved in it. Just watching the show and not taking it so seriously. Life is but a dream.
Is Nagarjuna breaking down the reality of time?
Oh, sure. Oh, for sure. Got a whole chapter on that, on the emptiness of time. There's no present without a past. There's no past without a present. There's no present or past without the future. They exist interdependently. They can only exist interdependently. There's no sense of saying present without referring to past and future. Yeah. And with any of them. There's no future without a past or a present. There's no past without a present and future. Did I get them all? Yeah. It's like he says in the chapter, it always reminds me of a Michael Jackson song. He says it's just like A, B, C. So he's a 1, 2, 3. So there's no 2 without 1 and 3. There's no C without A and B. There's no A without B and C. So these things exist interdependently. Can have meaning only interdependently.
That would be something.
Yes, it would.
Right now, our sense,
yeah.
Our concept,
yeah, linear time. Yeah. That's right.
Thank you for coming
and
teaching.
Thank you. Elizabeth?
I hope I said this right. When you were talking about the form, which are the five aggregates, then there's the immaterial. The thought. But I thought that at some time when we were doing independent originations in class, they used the word consciousness. And I've been trying to memorize, from the top down, like ignorance, karma, consciousness, and then the various, I don't know if that's the order. Are thoughts the same as consciousness? Because you've been using the word thoughts. Is it interchangeable? Because thoughts can be conscious or unconscious.
Consciousness is the ability to think. It's not the thought. It's not the thinking. It's the ability to think. Or the visual consciousness is the ability to see. The ability to make sense of the visual field. So within the, mental consciousness, the mind, within consciousness, then we have thought, which exists in that same kind of way that we talked about before. A thinker who has a thought and is thinking, and those things exist interdependently within the mental consciousness.
So it's again the same thing, like which comes first.
Yeah. Then the tricky bit is to think about what they talk about in a lot of non-Buddhist traditions, in Hindu India, of pure consciousness. Pure consciousness, Satchitananda, and my best understanding of that is pure consciousness is the condition of possibility for all consciousness. So it's not consciousness of something. It's like the snow globe in which the snowflakes are shaken up. But it's not a particular consciousness or a particular thought. It's pure in the sense that it is non-conceptual, completely non-conceptual. And that is a universal consciousness that we all living beings have. See, and then consciousnesses are particularized. Consciousness of something is particularized, but pure consciousness is universal. And in some texts like the Vijnana Bhairava Tantra, they say that one of the cool meditations that you can do is to think about the fact that your pure consciousness is exactly like everyone else's pure consciousness. Exactly. Undifferentiated. So I think, if you wanted to put that in Buddhist terminology, I think the closest thing would be Buddha nature, which is the Dharmakaya of a Buddha unrecognized. It is not that the Buddha nature turns into the Dharmakaya. It's just called something else when it's recognized or unrecognized. And that's a kind of a pure consciousness, too, to the best of my understanding of what they're talking about with the Dharmakaya, the mind of a Buddha.
And I just want
Cindy
to ask,
Lee. Cindy Lee.
I know this is just to clarify for the notes for the Middle Way course, but if Chapter 3 was talking about the 12 links of dependent origination, is Chapter 4 then continuing after grasping, you then go to becoming, and you rebirth in a sense, but when they're talking about becoming, are they then talking about form? Is that why he's talking about form? I mean, according to the commentaries, do they discuss chapter 4 as a continuation of the 12 weeks?
Not to my knowledge. But maybe you could make an argument for it. Can we just have like one more question, maybe?
Mark. I'm assuming that these are Yarjun didn't just write this stuff down. He actually lectured people, right?
Who knows? I don't really know.
Anyway, yeah. If he did, would his lecture change if all of the students were blind?
Wow.
Wow. Here's a thought.
why would it necessarily have to change, Mark?
Seeing and seeing.
Yeah. Well, you'd have to drop that one.
You
could have, but then you could like talk about hearing, you know,
right.
The hearing.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Lindsay?
Yeah. In terms of our own happiness, this all sounds like such a dance, such a, you know. I felt like this with my hand. I don't know what else to do. That we have been taught to try to be so diligent, to be honest with ourselves about our own actions and our own thoughts, to develop a certain consciousness about them, to be aware of them, mindful of them. Do we continue to do that in the same way in the presence of the knowledge that there is no self-existent cause and effect? Does that increase our faith that cause and effect will work, that self-examination is seriously important? Yes?
Hopefully.
Right. And that Nagarjuna is teaching us this in order for us to understand then why there could be transformation.
Well, I don't think Nagarjuna is trying to teach you anything. He's trying to unteach
you.
So Swami Satchitananda, one of the great yogis from the last century, was once asked, do you have to be a Hindu to be a yogi? And he said, I am not a Hindu. I am an undo. I am trying to undo, become more simple, you know, less complicated, more, you know, more basic, less, you know, intellectual, more childlike, like the Bible says, like in the Bible, in the New Testament, and also in the Tao Te Ching, be like a child. Not naive, not in the sense of naive, but in the sense of simple. Yeah. And so that's a very, very important goal, especially for eggheads, you know, especially for, and I'm talking about all of us here, we're all overeducated, you know, and we rely so much on our minds, so much on our intellects to try to navigate, you know, life. And that's gotten us pretty far, you know. But at a certain point, certainly, you know, in a certain point of the spiritual life, especially as you get older, I'd say, you know, on to undo and relax, sort of, you know, relax into life without trying to control it and manipulate it and figure it out and all of that. Yeah. So, you know, the spiritual life has many dimensions to it and kind of depends on your stage of life and where you are and so forth to know which one to emphasize and which one to... And which one to leave for later, but they are both necessary. You know, in the Chinese tradition, there used to be an understanding of Confucianism and Taoism, kind of working hand in hand, for you know a proper gentleman like these called gentlemen. So a gentleman would use Confucianism, which is filled with rules and regulations and etiquette and all of that, you know, for the public life, for the you know, interactions with other people in the public life. And then you go home to the study and use your Taoism and return to the simplicity, return to the quiet, the pacification of the mind and all like that, and alternate, you know, have an alternation in life. So it doesn't have to be one thing or the other. It depends, like, what's appropriate. When's it appropriate to get all, like, rule-bound and, you know, all of that? And when's it appropriate to let go?